In our last message in this series, when we left it, with the exile, the vote of the Council of Geneva to banish from Geneva William Farrell and John Calvin as threats to the public peace and welfare of the community. To many who observed that situation, the banishment of Calvin and Farrell from Geneva would have appeared to be the dashing of their fondest hopes for the reformation of that city. There would seem to be no other conclusion to reach than that the people of Geneva had turned away from the truth in their preference for the lifestyle being championed by the libertines. As the fiery Farrell and the slender Calvin disappeared down the road to Bern, the possibility of Geneva being governed in a righteous manner seemed to be vanishing as well. But the amazing thing is that Calvin was not in dismay. His trust in the Lord remained unshakable. He said, "Had we been the servants of men, we would now be ill repaid. But we serve a great master, who never lets those who serve him go unrewarded, and whoever pays them what he does not owe them." It is safe to conclude that the two travelers were not caught up in any self-pity as they continued their journey. It wasn't that they didn't care about what had happened. I wouldn't want you to get that idea. It wasn't the case that they didn't care about the people they had left behind in Geneva. But John Calvin and William Farrell had learned to submit their cause to the care of their God. And so, in calmness of soul, they did the only thing they could do. They went to another place. They wanted to explain to their supporters in Bern and in Zurich the circumstances that had led to their banishment from Geneva, because already rumors were flying that it was because of their poor conduct that they had been sent away. The government of Bern, at the instigation of the Council of Zurich, implored the Council of Geneva to reverse its edict of banishment and to receive Farrell and Calvin back, but the Council of Geneva refused steadfastly to do so. So the two exiles continued their journey on to Basel, and Calvin finally reached the destination for which he had set out during 1536, 2 years before. And when they arrived in Basel, Calvin received letters from Martin Bucer, who was leading the Reformation in Strasbourg. Bucer urged Calvin to come to that city to help in the work of gospel ministry there. And so it was to Strasbourg that John Calvin eventually repaired, where during a relatively brief interval, and I say that because it lasted only about 3 years, he continued his ministry and married a wife. The family life that Calvin began with his wife in Strasbourg was to continue in Geneva when Calvin was recalled eventually to that city. That family life was to make the 1540s the happiest period of Calvin's life. In the midst of all his labor for the Lord Jesus Christ, John Calvin proved that happy marriages do exist. His marriage to a widow provided him for nearly a decade with a haven that was sheltered from the momentous actions in which Calvin found himself engaged so often. It so happened that the period of banishment that would appear to be such a disaster, and here is where I link up with what we were considering this morning, became the means of giving Calvin yet another opportunity to put what he was preaching from the Scriptures into action in his own life. It gave him another opportunity to give the lie to the common misconceptions about him both at that time and since that time. Those were the attempts to label him as a cold and unfeeling monster who was more interested in the rationale of theology than he was in the feelings of people. It was said of Calvin that he was the Reformation's response to the bizarre and mind-numbing reasonings of the medieval scholastic theologians by whom Calvin had been trained. Any careful consideration of John Calvin during this interval between his first and second portions of ministry in Geneva must show him as a humble and compassionate man. His response to the persecution he had faced in Geneva was to commit his life into the hands of the righteous judge. And when he took such a course, he would find that the door had opened for a far wider ministry and would ultimately lead him back to Geneva in triumph. So what appeared to be a huge setback for the work of God in the lives of Calvin and Farrell and in the city of Geneva became a positive development for everyone concerned. Now, it did not appear that way when they were removed from Geneva. But without that forced removal from Geneva, Calvin would never have received the opportunity to apply in his own life and for others to behold the words of our Bible reading this evening. Calvin often would preach on the responsibility of husbands to love their wives. But it was not until he was forced to leave Geneva that he came to a situation where he himself could take those words to heart. We may say that Calvin's marriage and family life and his ministry of the word in the city of Strasbourg were the direct result of his exile from Geneva. Beyond those realities, we may also say that the people of Geneva would never have come to recognize what they had lost if Calvin had not been forced to leave the city. And it wasn't long before they did realize what they had lost. And so at times of adversity and even frustration in the work of God, it is well to remember the experience of John Calvin and to reflect on that which he proved to be true in his own life. For in his removal from Geneva, we find the powerful lesson of opposition's blessing. Opposition's blessing. It takes a person who is committed to the idea that God is sovereign to view the most personal rejection as a way of carrying out God's will. Just comes to my mind right now that Jonathan Edwards suffered what must have been a very personal rejection after 23 years of ministry in Northampton. And it would have taken him to understand the sovereignty of God to be able to absorb that rejection as a way of carrying out God's will. John Calvin, as we saw, had never intended to spend any time in Geneva. He wanted to be there only one night. That was his intention when he went there. But when Pharaoh prevailed on him to remain there, there were no guarantees that Calvin's efforts in Geneva would meet with the acceptance of the people. But to be banished officially by the council of the city of Geneva meant that Calvin had become persona non grata. So that someone who never even had the idea of being there at all now was described as somebody that they would not tolerate. It would have been hard to receive that action in any but the most personal terms. It was a rejection of him. Yet it's evident that even in such a time, Calvin was content to let the Lord rule in his life, and felt certain that there was a divine purpose, he didn't know what it was, in all that had happened. And that purpose, he knew, must be fulfilled. It wasn't that Calvin was uncaring. It wasn't that he blew the people of Geneva off and said, well, I've had it with them. On my way, we'll find somebody that's more appreciative. He was deeply concerned, as we will see, about what would happen in Geneva. But he had no power to influence that decision. And so he resolved he would not become frustrated by it, aside from explaining to others what had actually happened. Now, there's something for us to learn from his response to this opposition. It's very easy when we face opposition or when we see it, not directed at us personally, but at others. It's very easy to allow the rage to build inside when we perceive a personal slight to ourselves or to someone we know. It is even easier when we convince ourselves that this personal slight has happened because of the stand we have taken for the truth. Yet if we believe the Scriptures, then we must follow the example of our Savior and commit our cause to the great and eternal Judge who judges righteously. So Calvin did not go off from Geneva pouting that the people there just didn't appreciate his gifts and that they would never come to any good end as a result. Calvin simply turned his attention to other opportunities that God placed before him. And in that way, the rejection by Geneva became the cause for blessing in many other places, including in Calvin's own home. Now, this phase of Calvin's life divides into three parts. The first part I call a time for redirection. The time that Calvin had spent in Geneva, as you may remember from our last message, was very intense. You may remember the opposition by the Libertines, and in particular, the appearance on that Easter Sunday when both Farrell and Calvin were threatened physically by armed men. Now, I'm sure that was not particularly easy to take. So it wasn't exactly what we would call a relaxing time that they had spent there. And so there was forced upon them now a time for redirection. something different. The first stop for Calvin and Farrell was the city of Bern. And then they proceeded to Zurich. Zurich was the city that had been the scene of the labors of Ulrich Zwingli. And this was less than 10 years after Zwingli's death. And his successor, who was carrying on his work, Heinrich Bullinger, welcomed these two men with great warmth. And they commended them for their stand for Christ. After their visit to Zurich, Calvin and Farrell went on to Basel. And that is the city where Calvin had lived in times past and where he had labored on the institutes of the Christian religion. Now, Calvin's thought was when he arrived at Basel, he was going to just settle down there. He was going to resume his studies on which he had been intent 2 years before when he had been trying to reach that place. But when they arrived in Basel, Calvin received several letters from Martin Bucer. Martin Bucer was a protege both of Calvin and of Luther. He knew both of them. And he was laboring in the city called Strasbourg. Strasbourg is in the area that now is part of France. There's a border region between the German and French areas that has tended to flip-flop from one side of the border to the other, depending on the results of various wars. At this time, Strasbourg was a German city. Today it is in France. Well, Bucer wanted Calvin to come to Strasbourg and take up residence there, and his thinking was very much like that of Farrell in Geneva. Now, Bucer knew that Calvin had shown interest in the work in Strasbourg before, and Bucer was certain that Calvin's ministry would be received very well among the people there. But the problem was that in spite of the unusual circumstances of their first meeting, Calvin and Farrell, as unlikely as it seemed, had developed a very close friendship. They thought very highly of each other, and they didn't like the prospect of being separated. But Farrell had no interest in going to Strasbourg and leaving Basel. So it took Calvin some time to decide. Finally, he agreed to the invitation, and he left Farrell and went to Strasbourg, where he was to be for 3 years. Well, I say that was to be his base for 3 years, because periodically he traveled to other places, as we will see in connection with the work of the Reformation. But this period in Strasbourg, and I ask you to remember what we said about the departure from Geneva, this period in Strasbourg was to be the most peaceful and happy time in Calvin's life. He would never have known it without the circumstances that forced him out of Geneva. The people of Strasbourg and the leaders of the town appreciated the reputation that Calvin had. Here was this man whose name was known all across Europe, even though he had not yet reached the age of 30. Now, when Calvin arrived in Strasbourg, he began the work of the ministry. Now, one of the things that he did that Bucer wanted Calvin's help with was to take a group of French refugees. Remember, I was saying Strasbourg was a German city at this time. Well, a number of French people had come from various parts of France as a result of persecution. They were Protestants. They were being persecuted by the King of France, Francis I, and so they left their homes and they went to Strasbourg, but they were French speakers, and they found themselves in a German city. So They wanted to worship with the German Protestants of the city, but they couldn't understand German. And so Bucer asked Calvin if he would help in what was becoming a bilingual ministry in Strasbourg. And that is, he wanted Calvin to organize these refugees into a French church. And here was the genius of the whole thing. The French congregation worshipped in the same building as was used by the German congregation. So you had two Protestant congregations. One had services in German, the other had services in French. Bucer led the services in the one, Calvin led the services in the other. And that was, I suppose, one of the earliest examples of a multilingual ministry. So he carried on his pastoral work, both among the French people and also among the German people. That involved regular preaching. But he also engaged in a series of public lectures to which the town council invited him and which they authorized, although they didn't appropriate any money to pay him for his efforts. These were lectures on the Bible. Now, I want you to think about this because it's a striking thing to me. Suppose that today we were to advertise that there were going to be lectures on the Bible. No bands, no visual projections, you know, nothing of the, just lectures on the Bible where we would get up and simply explain what the Bible had to say. What kind of a response do you think there would be? Well, in Strasbourg, there was a tremendous response. As time went by, the audiences grew because there were people who wanted to know what the Bible said. And they sensed here was a man who knew what the Bible said and could communicate it to them. There was a great hunger for the Word of God. During this period, Calvin depended for his support on the sale of his books. There were people who tried to give him money. He refused it, even from Farrell. During 1539, in addition to his pastoral work and his lectures, he turned his attention back to the institutes of the Christian religion. Remember, we took a whole message to deal with that work that he had published a few years before. Well, he engaged in 1539 in an extensive revision and expansion and reorganization of that work so that it came to resemble then the form that it has now when it is published. So he was doing that as well. You may wonder how he had time to do anything else. Beyond that work, as if that were not enough, he began the task of turning his lectures on the Bible. And he had lectured on various books of the Bible in Strasbourg. He was lecturing on the Gospel of John. He began to turn those lectures into commentaries on the Bible. And that was a work that would become one of his great legacies to the generations that came after him. For his commentaries were much different than any that people had seen before. They abandoned the standard allegorical approach of the Middle Ages and focused instead on the actual meaning of the text, or what was called the historical grammatical interpretation of the scriptures. Calvin was also keeping in touch with those he had left behind in Geneva. Just 3 months after he left Geneva, he wrote to the people there in these words, "Though discharged for the present from the administration of the church at Geneva, Nevertheless, this cannot deprive me of bearing towards her a paternal love and charity. Towards her, I say, over whom God once ordained me, and so has obliged me forever to keep faith and loyalty with her. So he was very anxious to hear news out of Geneva. But behind the scenes in Geneva, now that Calvin was gone, there were those intent on seeing Romanism restored in the city. Cardinal Sadolet, the Bishop of Geneva, who also had been kicked out of Geneva by the council, wrote a crafty and flattering letter that was addressed to the Senate and people of Geneva. And in that letter, he tried to suggest that the answer for all the problems that they were having in Geneva, the best way forward was for them to reinstitute the Roman form of worship in the city. Now, there were still pastors in Geneva who were Reformed. They were Protestant. But they didn't feel that they could answer that letter, and so they forwarded it to John Calvin. And Calvin responded. And he did so with such great skill that when Martin Luther saw a copy of the letter, he wrote these words, "Here is a writing which has hands and feet. I rejoice that God raises up such men. They will continue what I have begun against the Romish Antichrist." That was what Luther had to say about that letter of Calvin. So, I say all this to say it was evident that Calvin, now that he had been removed from Geneva, had not turned within himself. He had not become a hermit. He was still very much active in the ministry of the Word. But the time in Strasbourg did give him the opportunity to work away from the heat of controversy. So it was a time of redirection. He took advantage of this time for another part of the ministry that he considered to be very important. That's the second phase that I would suggest to you, a time for integration. A time for redirection and a time for integration. And here I want to deal with one of the burdens of Calvin's heart during his whole ministry. And here again is an area where Calvin has been largely neglected. He was a man who sought the welfare of the Church of Christ at large. That is, Calvin was not concerned only with the churches directly under his care. He was concerned with the whole welfare of the church. Calvin longed to see the establishment and the maintenance of real fellowship among the branches of the Protestant Reformation that were distinguished from each other by particular views on certain subjects. Calvin's view was that their differences should not be allowed to keep them apart when they were in agreement on the cardinal doctrines of the gospel. During his time at Strasbourg, Calvin took the opportunity to travel to several German cities, including Frankfurt and Worms, where he became better acquainted with the leaders of the German Reformation, principally Philip Melanchthon. I pointed out before that Calvin never met Luther. That, I suppose, is something that historians have always wished would have happened. But they never met, although they did correspond. But Calvin and Melanchthon became very close friends. Even though, again, in many ways, their views were opposed to each other. But they did seek to encourage each other, and so close was their friendship that Calvin felt at liberty on occasion to rebuke Melanchthon sharply. In 1531, on one such occasion, Calvin wrote, "Either I understand nothing in holy things, or you ought not to have yielded thus to papists. We should not be afraid to write with our ink upon paper what so many martyrs write daily with their blood upon the scaffold. I speak with all frankness. My sole desire is that nothing should distress the truly divine greatness of your soul. If I appear to you vehement, it is because I would 100 times rather die with you for the truth than see you survive the truth betrayed by you. Is this to say that I mistrust you? No, but I desire you to take sufficient precautions so that your easiness should not furnish the impious with the opportunity which they seek of scoffing at God's truth." He was saying to Melanchthon, don't let your warmth of personality be mistaken as a lack of resolve to stand for the truth. Now, the chief division between Calvin and the German reformers was over the question of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. The German reformers, Luther principally among them, were of the opinion that the body of Christ was actually present in the Lord's Supper, not in the elements, but above and underneath and around the elements. Calvin did not agree with that view, nor did Zwingli. But Calvin understood that this difference of opinion was not a difference that ought to keep these brethren from fellowship with each other and from working with each other. Writing to Bullinger concerning Luther, Calvin wrote, "I conjure thee never to forget how eminent a man Luther is and with what gifts he is endowed. Think with what strength of soul, what immovable perseverance, what potency of doctrine he has devoted himself now to the overthrowing of Antichrist. As for me, I have often said, and I still repeat it, if he were to call me a devil, I should not cease to hold him in great esteem and to acknowledge in him an illustrious servant of God. I would say to you that that is a spirit that is not too often to be found in the world today." Calvin then was a true churchman, and his time away from Geneva enabled him to cultivate this area of his ministry. He always sought the welfare of all who truly belonged to Christ. He championed the cause of all of Christ's people, pressing the battle for the cause of Christ's kingdom. So it was a time of integration. But there was one other important facet of this period in Calvin's life, and that is a time for satisfaction. Calvin was not married, and we shouldn't believe for a moment that his friends had not noticed this reality and had been urging him for quite some time to rectify this situation. They kept telling them, you need to be married, you need to have a wife. As Luther had married Catherine von Bora, they were urging Calvin that he needed to be married. And Calvin would put them off, yes, I hear what you're saying, but it was not until he was in Strasbourg, where again he felt some release from the pressure, that he began to consider the matter seriously. Now, Calvin was, of course, well aware of the model that is expounded in the portion of Ephesians from which we have read this evening. And I would just draw your attention to a couple things that are said in those verses that we read. Notice in particular the goal that Christ had for His church, that He might present it to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. He spoke in verse 32 of this great mystery concerning Christ and the church, and of the way in which Christ loved the church and gave Himself for it. So He was very much taken with this picture in the Scriptures of the relationship between Christ and the church, and how the relationship between the husband and the wife should picture that. So Calvin was anxious to find a wife who would meet the standards of Ephesians 5. A woman who would be able to care for her husband, who would be unconcerned about the frivolity of the world. He wrote to Farrell, "Would you know what kind of beauty could alone win my soul? It is kindness and modesty, linked to simplicity, contentment, and meekness." Now I say that's a good model for every young man to follow. He wasn't necessarily opposed to physical beauty, because the woman he eventually married was a very noble woman. But he was well aware of the fact that for many women, that was all they had. Martin Bucer introduced Calvin to a widow. Her name was Idelette de Burr, and he found in her that she met what he was looking for. Now, they didn't go through an elaborate courtship ritual or anything like that. He met her, and having been satisfied with her, he proposed that they should be married. And she accepted. She was a widow. He knew her before. In fact, he knew her first husband, who had died. He was a Baptist. Both of them had become persuaded of the Reformed faith under Calvin's own ministry. So he knew her before. But now, here was this widow, already with several children of her own, and she and Calvin were married. The date was August the 1st, 1540. Calvin was 31 years old, and his wife was somewhat older. It was a great event, a great occasion. Friends and official visitors came from various places all around Switzerland and Germany and France. There was a tremendous celebration. And it was Calvin's testimony that he found to be true in his own situation, the words that we read in Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 22. "Whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing, and obtaineth favor of the Lord." Calvin always thought that he had been blessed by the Lord in terms of his wife. They had a son. And here again is another stereotype of Calvin exploded, that he was a cold and unfeeling ascetic. Well, he couldn't have been. He must have been a romantic of some measure. They had a son. And for a time, the two of them were able to cherish their son. But like so many children in that time, the little boy did not live very long. And so great sorrow came into their home. But even after that great sorrow, It was said of Calvin and his wife that they displayed a remarkable affection for each other and loyalty to each other. Calvin was often unwell. It's another aspect of his life that many ignore. He was often unwell. And she devoted herself to caring for him for the rest of her days. There were times when he was so beset by various depressions and various types of headaches and all other kinds of physical ailments that he had probably brought on himself by not eating as much as he should have earlier in his life. There were times when she just held his head in her hands and sought to comfort him. When he was well, she walked with him. When he was under attack, she prayed for him. She was known, once they took up residence in Geneva, for her legendary care of the sick and afflicted of that city. She would visit them on a regular basis, even at great peril to her own health. She faced the trials, not only of seeing the son that she had with Calvin die, but other children die as well. Finally, in 1548, her own health deteriorated, and she passed away. And Calvin wrote of her passing in very tender terms. He said, "Because you know the tenderness, or rather the weakness of my heart, you are convinced that I could not have borne this pain if I had not concentrated the whole power of my soul in God. The best of partners has been taken from me. She was willing to share with me banishment and want, and would have gone with me into death. She was also a great help in my official life." And he never forgot her, and never thought of marrying again, for he did not believe anyone could take her place. All of this came about because Calvin was banished from Geneva. All of this came about because it appeared that he had been rejected, that his ministry had been repudiated. But the reality was, God was calling him to far wider work. When we look at Ephesians chapter 5, we ought to be struck by this great truth. Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. Calvin sought to emulate that love. He loved the church. He devoted himself to its care, and indeed devoted his life to its service. There was in the opposition in Geneva a great blessing. It was a blessing for Calvin. But I say it was a blessing for those who came after Calvin, for the work that he did in Strasbourg during those years is work from which we benefit to this very day. And so we have entered in to the blessing of that opposition. May God then encourage you to regard adversity as Calvin regarded, as the opportunity for the blessing of God.